So what would be lovely would be just to go around and either chairs or someone else from the group, you know, who's kind of got the thought, doesn't really matter, but just a minute or so on something that came out of your group and say what, whether you're a personal formation or a mysticism gnosis group and so on, just so we know quite where we're at as well. And we'll just go around that for a few minutes before we have the break at 4:15. David.
So we're starting over here, and then I'll pass the mic to maybe this way. This way, okay. Right, sorry, well, but so this is personal formation. The first thing we noted down was formation / transformation. And so we've been thinking about this in terms of individuality, community, life cycles, different phases, the need for a sense of rootedness, to rediscover a sense of rootedness, connectedness, belonging, and then we finished on the need for systems change, personal, social, planetary. That's probably enough, but there's a huge number of ideas here.
Okay, so let me just ask you a quick sort of, just to tease that, what's the most pressing element within that? Did you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think it has to be transformation. I mean, there's a recognition of this, and that's really the key word, formation, transformation.
Thank you very much. So you guys two here were doing personal formation as well. Someone like to grab the mic?
I hesitate to speak on behalf of our group, but following on from what the table over there said, I think we found it hard to talk about personal transformation without taking into account the material and political circumstances in which that might be possible for everyone and not just for individuals. And we started talking about empathy very quickly after we considered what the meaning of personal transformation might be.
Did you have some sense of how that collective aspect can shift?
Not a particularly cohesive sense of it, no, but I think we were interested in the that the discussion took that particular direction or vector, as it were.
Thank you very much. So these are number twos here, moving on, thinking about spiritual traditions more.
We have ended up with four headlines. So we began with the idea that the move, the impetus comes from the outside. It's come from the outside of the religious traditions and sort of impressed in upon it and influenced where we are today. That actually one response would be, or the response that's needed, we picked up on that theme of humility, and that we don't know where we're going, that this sense that we can, as a set of institutions, decide what's going to happen next is just not a reality, and that we need to gain that humility. And alongside that is the third issue of complexity and simplicity, that it's either all really complex, or it's all really simple, or it's neither, or it's both. And kind of we wrestled with that quite a lot. And then we kind of thought, we took the idea of this helix, this U-shape, the fall from consciousness into this depth of materialism, and then our growth out, and we were reminded of more of a helix shape, as Brueggemann's sort of idea of orientation, disorientation, and reorientation, and we wondered if we could play with that as a way of making our way through this morass. And we, folks, I'm just going to add the fifth, which is we started just before the time ran out, talking about, for instance, pilgrimage as a way of blending this, as rediscovering those ancient traditions, which those without outside formal religion can relate to, and yet the institutions have a deep and resonant pool of resources that can maybe bring a richness and an enrichment.
Yes, so this kind of, there are rich traditions, there are rich thought, which people like, well, that's Walter Brueggemann, is it? But that he started to articulate, but a kind of openness to share it, perhaps. Would that be a fair way of putting it? Yeah, okay, thank you. So these guys here, too, were thinking about the religious traditions.
Hi, yeah, vast sheets covered in writing. We had quite a wide-ranging thing, but we came, I think, to a kind of consensus around the kind of crisis, change, and hope. We really want to think about what hope was. But basically, I think we all agreed that we are facing an unprecedented crisis at the level of the environmental crisis and possibly also at a crisis of sort of meaning and purpose. And that we didn't think that the rationalistic materialist mindset that, if you like, got us into this mess is the same mindset that can necessarily get us out of it. That we need some kind of shift of consciousness or some kind of shift of entire way of configuring it. And then we had quite a lot of discussion about the way the different traditions represented here. We've got Christianity, we've got an interest in Buddhism, we've got some Sufi things, we've got Jewish. And we're just drawing on those. We felt that somehow those old stories are either coming back to haunt us or coming back to prompt or renew us, that they somehow have a renewed relevance. And I think we were just getting to the point of saying, maybe the keepers of those stories aren't the best interpreters of them. Maybe those of us that have got these great stories about fall and about the cross and salvation don't get what they're really saying to everybody. We need to kind of let those stories teach us again. But if we don't change the mindset, then we have no hope.
So what does that look like? Just a vignette. What might that look like when someone else takes hold of an element, as it were, and renews it?
Well, I gave an example of Barfield getting hold of a Norse story. Obviously, very few people are following the worship of Odin, but the story about Odin hanging himself on the world tree and then going down and losing an eye in order to learn runes. Barfield says he gains knowledge, but at the cost of one of his two eyes. And that is exactly what we've done in the modern West. We've gained extraordinary knowledge and power, but we're only looking at the world with one eye. We haven't got the eye of the imagination open anymore. So that was an example of an old story that suddenly seems to connect in a new way. But we were certainly looking at stories, obviously, of the death and resurrection of Christ and of Eden and the tree of knowledge. That became, I think, quite an important story for us. So I think we were saying that they've got a new relevance. And we had a lovely comment, actually, about hope, about if we're in a static world, if nothing ever changes or evolves or develops purposefully, then there is no hope. But if we're in a dynamic, both of consciousness and of universe, then there's hope. Is that fair?
Thank you very much indeed. So we mention of universe there, we move on to the guys considering, the first of the groups thinking about the scientific side, the worldview side from this point of view. Someone like to offer a thought?
Well, so we've come up essentially with two questions, but it was quite a large and wide-ranging conversation. Does spirituality need science as much as science needs spirituality? We spoke about that, spirituality, also creativity. And our second question was, to what extent is social media influencing the evolution of consciousness?
So give us a quick first sort of thought answer on that. The science, spirituality, and then social media.
So the science, spirituality one kind of came out of... just going to go back over it.
Perhaps I could just interject for a moment. I think our foundational question was whether, by looking at the way science has evolved, one could gain some insight into the evolution of consciousness. And we had several thoughts about that contrast between ancient science and science as we know it today. We were looking for a short while at the growth of an experimental methodology in the 17th century where, for the first time, arguably, consciousness came out of the natural philosophers and into the world, by dint of the fact that no longer was nature studied through an act of contemplation, but primarily through an act of intervention and intrusion. Because the Baconian empiricist methodology in the sciences involves putting nature on the rack. It involves you as the individual scientist doing something about nature. And we had a very helpful complementary contribution on the way from the history of art, from the history of theatre. One might also be able to see very clearly where these phase changes have taken place. And that's how we got onto the social media as well, because there seems to be a phase change happening in our very midst. So that's basically what we were saying.
So you guys were thinking about the science side perhaps as well?
Okay, so we had three thoughts essentially coming out of a creative primordial soup of creative thinking. The first one was on the meaning of consciousness, where we discussed reactions, responses, awareness, consciousness, and self-consciousness. There's a sort of a hierarchy going up there. And from self-consciousness to the idea of freedom, and then from that to the idea of freedom as a free acceptance of constraints, which, of course, are present in the material world in which we live. And so then I think the main conclusion from that was that the freedom that we have is in the mind, and that that's where the total freedom is, but that the rest is constraint. The second thought was whether science itself ever had a worldview anyway, because it stands that it should, in fact, have a neutral point. It should not have a worldview. It just tells what the truth is. And then society into which it feeds its information is the thing that produces a worldview. And then the discussion went in many directions. Usually freedom was a sort of theme that kept recurring. But from that, I think we can distill out that to make any changes within this new society into which we're heading, the intelligence, the decisions need to be collective and from a free imagination. So that theme reemerged again. And the last thing, the word evolution was mentioned, and this was quite an interesting idea, actually. There was someone commented that basically at the moment we are a super organism of information, and then using that as a model, we can also perhaps expect that enlightenment, too, cannot be at an individual level, but at a sort of communal enlightenment. That's perhaps what we can expect in the future. And I suppose that correlates very nicely with Barfield's idea of final participation. So that was us.
Early signs of communal enlightenment at all? Where would you sort of look for that emerging? Because presumably you need to look if it is a collective thing.
Or someone in the group.
Can anyone who is enlightened, enlighten me.
Just a hint, even, a hint.
Yes, I can give a hint, and that is that we are here to do exactly that.
Okay, very good, thank you, thanks.
So now we're moving on to the mysticism, gnosis, more esoteric element perhaps. A first thought developing it in this direction.
Interesting group, because of course we all have completely different experiences of mysticism. So we really moved on from that to I think the agreement that mysticism is essentially a connection with the unknowable, and there are many roots to that. And so that gave us a commonality to talk about. But where we really ended up was with the agreement that the world is in a really shocking state, and it reflects us. It is our outcome, as it were. And we were particularly depressed by the presence of what really you can only describe as evil, actually, and the power that this has over institutions and interpersonal relationships and all the rest of it. And our takeout from this was that the only way and the necessary and absolutely essential way forward is through the imagination and through the intentional use of it for good in the world. Does that...
I think. Did the diversity feel like a help or a hindrance?
Gang?
Or something else?
Both.
Help.
Help.
Yeah.
Reality.
I mean, it's always good to hear what other people, how they experience that thing that is up there somewhere that you can't put into words. And I think we really had this around this table. But the imagination and the creative and how that can be taught and used for positive effects and how we need to reflect that or else we will just get worse. I think that was the, you know, we got to do something. and being of service to the world rather than thinking of ourselves as all-powerful individuals.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for that, for expressing some of that. Another table.
Yes, well, I think we had some similar thoughts, actually, on our table. We were doing also mysticism and gnosis, but perhaps with a slightly different emphasis that we were particularly, I think, ended up talking about the connection between personal and private experiences and public, and how it may be appropriate to convey what goes on for us in any of our individual subjective practices that open up doorways for us, and whether it's something that, in fact, we feel that we need to, or there's a language for being able to share with the rest of society. And we had a debate about whether or not that's something actually that, in principle, can be done at all, and whether there's any kind of, what are the restrictions out there? Are these sort of linguistic confusions or more kind of social or even political taboos? Obviously, the whole sort of question of science as inhibiting spiritual questions or spiritual development. And this came out in actually in quite a nice little phrase that popped up early on in the discussion when one of the people at our table was wondering whether, for those of us who are interested in consciousness and spirituality, we too need a me too kind of a moment, and possibly what that might look like, do we actually feel oppressed in any sense? I don't know if there's a... But I thought it was a very nice tie between the sort of idea of me too and I am.
Yes, taboo is a good Barfieldian word. He often talks about that. And also, someone who's here in spirit today, if not in actuality, is Rupert Sheldrake. And Rupert was saying that that daring to think and then daring to try and speak and so on is a really key part of things, actually. Giving permission to yourself, in a way, but also then to others. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So we spoke of... We began speaking quite introspectively, I think, about the idea of knowing and how you come to knowing through trauma and letting go of your past or coming to terms with your past to then step into your flow state or a space where you're not trying to control the future or the past, to actually experience things as they are and accept them and surrender into the flow and weave into one another. So maybe the idea that we're all worlds colliding and we're all weaving together to create a pattern that could bring us to a sense of unity, a beautiful path together. We spoke of the idea that we get a choice before we come through to this world and we pursue a passion, a purposeful passion that is maybe for this era, a more humanitarian age, and we come together to try and alleviate suffering. And also we spoke of the etheric energy grid, and how certain experiences, as we come together, maybe, so we use the example of the Apollo missions and millions of people coming together for to experience something as a whole has changed perception on a global scale, and that connected to the idea of the media controlling our perceptions, and that we're going through though we have this access to the grid and we are all connected in the hive mind, we are currently separating and ionizing, as Richard said, and becoming atoms in chaos. But through that chaos, we'll come to an interconnected flow that is more beneficial and hopefully brings us out of our pain at the moment and the global suffering that we're all experiencing inwardly and outwardly. And yeah.
So it sounds like vision is a really key thing, actually. I mean, things can go very wrong, but don't lose touch with your vision. Yeah, okay, well, thank you very much. And then finally, you guys here, another group on the mysticism and Gnostic side.
Thank you. So we started off saying why we had drawn to this table, and similarly it was for personal reasons, whether it's through mystical experience that we're trying to understand or knowledge that we're trying to unpack for ourselves. And then we sort of talked about the different... We had two main different views. One was that this world can appear like a prison and we need to escape it, and some of us did esoteric practices to do that. And the other was to work through this prison, so that through suffering or pain, that would be transmuted into compassion, love, joy, and empathy. And also we had the idea of we need to accept a state of not knowing. We never really, with our small state of consciousness as it is, we can't know everything. And finally, we sort of came to what their conclusion was of the second table of number four, was that we live in a participatory universe, and it's sort of our jobs to bring through our knowledge and our esoteric sort of curiosity and hopefully acquired wisdom, and to integrate it, so not keep it for personal anymore, to bring it out, and hopefully it could be integrated into the mainstream in whatever small way we're capable of doing it like that.
Thank you very much. That sort of feels like the obstacles are the way, or the Christian inflection would be take up your cross, or the alienation has meaning, and so on. Something like that.
What Hattie said, we didn't try to have a consensus. Clearly there are different views about what we do with esoteric knowledge, understanding, and you've expressed that already very well, but it's clear that this is an area for further discussion. You know, we didn't all agree with everything, and that didn't really matter.
Thank you very much.